the Alaska World Affairs Council Presents on KSKA Anchorage. I'm Kristen Spack. The Alaska World Affairs Council brings the world to Alaska. World leaders, journalists, authors, educators, and entrepreneurs join Alaskans in a conversation about world affairs. This week, Ambassador of the Russian Federation to the United States, Sergey Ivanovich Kislyak, speaks on Russia and Russian relations with the United States. Ambassador Kislyak has been an employee of the Foreign Ministry of the Russian Federation and the Soviet Union before the Russian Federation since 1977. Before becoming ambassador to the United States, he served as deputy director of the Department of International Scientific and Technical Cooperation, director of the Department of International Scientific and Technical Cooperation, and director of the Department of Security Affairs and Disarmament of the Foreign Ministry of Russia. Today, he is considered one of Russia's top disarmament experts. In 1998, he became ambassador of the Russian Federation to Belgium and simultaneously permanent representative of Russia to NATO in Brussels. He has served as deputy minister of foreign affairs for Russia since 2003 and now the ambassador of the Russian Federation to the United States for close to 100 days. In Anchorage, on Friday, January 2nd, Ambassador Kislyak spoke at the Alaska World Affairs Council on his country and Russia's relations with the United States. In partnership with the Alaska World Affairs Council, KSKA presents Ambassador of the Russian Federation to the United States, Sergey Ivanovich Kislyak.
Thank you very much for this hospitality and warm welcome. It's a real treat to be here in Alaska. It's my first. It's not the first year that I spend or I'm spending in the United States. I served here from 81 to 89 in different capacities in New York and Washington. But I never was allowed to go to Alaska because at that time, when I was invited to speak here, it was considered to be a red zone for Russian diplomats, Soviet diplomats. So I was denied access, and it's my first, and I am extremely pleased to be here. And to me, it's as if you come to your childhood, because we almost lost the white snow, white winters of the kind you enjoy here in Alaska. And sometimes I'm reminded of the maximum given by Newton, that if in some place something has disappeared, it must be in other place that it appears. So I know where the Moscow winters went. I hope that the frost outside is not the only reason why we have so many people here today. And I'm extremely delighted to address Russian-American relations in general, and maybe with some particular accent, what Alaska-Russian relations might mean. And I would like to deal with three large rubrics. One, how the Russian-American relations are perceived today. Second, what they are in reality. Third, how they should develop, especially when you think about this here in Alaska. First, what is the perception of Russian-American relations? If you open up Washington Post or Washington Times each and every morning the way I do, I have a feeling that we almost are getting back to the Cold War. The things that are being written about Russia are very non-complimentary, to be polite, and sometimes are absolutely non-informative. If you ask me, is it the same picture in Russia about the United States? To some degree, not to the same, but to some, yes. And then you ask yourself, why it is so? That after all these years of great expectations of bettering in our relations, we are where we are. It's certainly a big philosophical question, and maybe each and every of us would have his or her particular answer to that. I have one simple answer. When I came here in 81, it was the peak of the Cold War. It was difficult for a Russian diplomat to work in the United States, psychologically, not physically. However, physically, there were also some problems that we had experienced, even with physical security of Russian diplomats here in the States. When I was leaving Washington in 89, I took away with me issue of Time magazine. We had a portrait of Gorbachev, Bush the Elder, and Reagan on the backdrop of the New York skyline. It was after the first visit by Gorbachev here. And I was thinking that, for me, 8 years in the United States and a sea change in our relations. There were so many expectations as to how our relations would develop further. Russia was expecting that the United States will become a real friend. Here in the United States, there were also expectations that the Russian Federation will become, I do not know what, friend or a partner or associated state to the United States, but with nuclear weapons. But one way or another, I think the history proved that both expectations were a little bit too optimistic, because there had been interest that we were pursuing, there had been interests that the United States were pursuing, and the history proved that sometimes these interests didn't coincide, and we are yet to learn to respect each other's interests the way they need to be treated. Of course, I will give you our Russian view as to what went wrong, and our American colleagues might give you a little bit different picture, and it's normal because each of us has his or her own perspective of how things should develop and how they are developing. I will start with difficult problems. Difficult problems that are still looming in our relations are, I would say, in general terms, a lack of willingness by our American partners to treat our interests the way they want to treat that they want us to treat American interests. We see things that are happening that are detrimental to our sense of security. We live in a particular world. We have a history of relations with the West, with NATO. We still haven't overcome, when I say we, I mean we Russians and you, the Americans, together. We haven't overcome the mentality of the deterrence, of the balance of capabilities to deter each other, that is still in our heads as one of the prerequisites of stability in the world. But at the same time, we see things happening that are undermining that sense of stability, at least as far as Russia is concerned. The expansion of NATO, for example, is being considered as less than stable for us, because NATO as an organization hasn't changed to the extent that it would be considered as innocuous and benign instrument next to Russian borders. NATO proved lately to be less than respectful to our national interests. The reaction by NATO, for example, to the events in South Ossetia were predominantly anti-Russian and based not on the reality on the ground, but based on the instincts. Everything that is Russia doing presumably is wrong because it's Russia that is doing it. But in South Ossetia, what we were doing, we were protecting people. We were protecting peacekeepers who were sent there to maintain peace, and they were shot at point blank, cowardly and cruelly. We were protecting people that were shelled by MLRS, multiple launch rocket systems, that are of Soviet production. We know them better than others. They cannot point at military targets. They cover surfaces, and they were covering surfaces in the middle of the night, of the center of the sleeping city of Tsinvali. But what happened next? Reaction of NATO, reaction of the United States was instinctively, I would say, anti-Russian. Currently, when the facts are surfacing up, we are witnessing a recognition that the war wasn't started by Russia, that it were not us who were killing innocent people. We were responding by military force to the military force that had been launched against innocent civilians, and against Russian peacekeepers who had been there on the basis of international agreement to maintain peace, who didn't have even armor or heavy weapons to protect themselves. They didn't have anything but Kalashnikovs on their laps when they were attacked by T-72s point blank. We see, first time in history, the United States deploying a component of its strategic forces in Europe. And I'm talking about the radar system and the anti-missile system in Czech Republic and in Poland. You in Alaska have similar elements here. We didn't react too much about it being here because it's part of the strategic balances that we all maintain. But bringing these systems to Russian, if may, underbelly, certainly can potentially be very destabilizing. We have been telling to our American colleagues how we feel about it. We have been trying to engage in a dialogue that would bring an understanding that instead of unilateral deployment, we can do better by working together and developing a system that would be give us early warning on any potential deployment of threatening missiles, weapons, or nuclear weapons that would be threatening to you or to us, but doing together in a way that wouldn't be detrimental to each other's security or wouldn't be launching a system that would have to be countered by the other side. So far, we haven't been able to find a solution that would be acceptable to us and to the United States, and we see what is happening. The United States deciding that the political background around events in South Ossetia would be most propitious has accelerated signature of the agreements that would solidify decisions to deploy. We had to react. We had to say from the very beginning up front as to what our reaction is going to be. And we were accused of threatening the United States. It's less than honest. We see a lot of other smaller and bigger things happening in our relations that unnecessarily create an impression that our relations went absolutely wrong. They do experience a lot of problems. There were rising harsh rhetorics lately, especially after the events in South Ossetia. Currently, I think, and as I said, my judgment is that it's due to the facts becoming known to larger audience. These rhetorics are subsiding. The discussions that we have with the current administration and hopefully with the future administration of this United States is more geared towards the future, and we are thinking about how to build these relations into the future. And I think that the basis for truthful and serious cooperation between two of us is there objectively. And here I come to what the relations between our two countries are. They are not limited only to NATO expansion or deployment of anti-ballistic missile systems in Europe or U.S. reaction to the events in South Ossetia. We have larger relations, much more complex, much more developed, and they are sometimes developing in pretty reliable fashion and to the good of both nations. If we take, for example, our economic relations, irrespective of ups and downs in our political dialogue, the current estimate for the results of the 2008 is that we will have about 34 plus minus billion dollars of trade in 2 years. It's not too high a number. 34 billion for the countries with the sizes of economy like yours and ours. Ours is a little bit smaller, but still very significant. It's the fourth of the fifth in the world currently. 34 billion isn't much. United States for us is not the prime economic partner. Europeans and Chinese are. Europe as a whole, EU, is the biggest economic partner for Russia, not the United States. If you take individual countries like Germany, for example, the turnover with Germany would be something three to four times greater. The size of our relations with economic relations with the United States is comparable with medium-sized European partners of ours. The trade between two of us for the United States is very minuscule. it's only 1% of foreign trade of the United States. At the same time, what I would like to add, that within a short period of time, within 4 last years, these economic exchanges have grown 3 times. And what is amazing is the tempo. We have started almost with zero. Only 4 years ago, it was around 9 billion. Currently, it's 34 within that short period of time. That's important. Certainly, one can say that partially this rise is can be justified or explained by the rise of prices on commodity, but it's only percentages. But otherwise, the exchanges have grown, and we even see large American investments in the Russia, leading to open up automotive production facilities and many other things. But at the same time, roughly around the same period of time, Russian business has invested in the United States $8 billion. It's private money, it's non-governmental. Within approximately the same period of time, United States business has invested also around $8 billion in Russia. So we are moving almost on a parity in terms of tempo of mutual investment. And it is good. President Bush and President Putin had agreed back in Bratislava that they would be encouraging mutual investment, and I underline the word mutual. And it's something that is occurring and being supported by the two governments, irrespective of ups and downs in our dialogue. And the business communities of the two countries, they seem to be becoming more and more involved in even discussing the political dialogue between us, because they are interested in stability and predictability of those relations. Before leaving to work in Washington, I had a number of meetings with the key American companies operating in Russia, and the main story that I was hearing from them was that they're doing fine, they know how to operate there, and they want to continue. The same with ours that have invested here in the United States. At the same time, once again, irrespective of what is happening in our dialogue on other issues, we do have a number of important projects that we are shouldering together. The space program, the space station. It's multilateral, but it's backbone of Russian space program, it's a backbone of US space program, and it's run together. And when the shuttle went through problems, we were ensuring access to the space station by Russian boosters. And it's going to continue irrespective of what is happening in our dialogue, because your country and ours believe that space station is not only a symbol of what can unite us, but it's something that serves your long-term technological interests and it serves Russian technological interests. And we, the two countries, can show leadership that can bring to the space EU, Japan, Canada, and other participants. We also do together a wonderful project that I am proud of, because I was part of this project from the very beginning, and that is a global initiative to combat nuclear terrorism. It's a project that maybe isn't known too much by a large public, but it's something very, very amazing. We, United States and Russia, have launched a international program whereby we are inviting countries to join us in developing national programs to protect nuclear materials, nuclear technology, in a way that would deny access to them to terrorists. Nexus between terrorists and nuclear materials or nuclear weapons seem to be currently one of the most threatening challenge that your country and ours face. We have started, 2 of us. In a year, we had 10 countries, EU mainly, joining us. Now we have 75 countries that are working on this. I hope in a couple of years, if we meet in the same room, I will be able to report you almost a global character of this program. And it's so important that we do it together, because terrorists, they do not know borders. They make use of modern communications, freedom of travel, much faster than the governments are able to reunite the actions and to coordinate the deeds in order to combat this threat. We do a lot of other small and bigger things together that without the United States or without Russia are simply unthinkable. I would like to add to this that we are running or participating together and developing new generation of technological marvels to bring new sources of energy, like fusion energy, some others. We do it together. We have expanded culture exchanges also, and that is something that is bringing more and more understanding of each other. And that is something that, if you look at the current wave of publications about Russia here, and sometimes a wave of publications about the United States in Russia, is largely ignored. But it's something that is continuing. Both governments are very much interested, and there are a lot of other things that we can and we need, and we do work together. Let's take regional crises, Middle East. We work in quartet together because we understand that without the United States, we cannot do things important. And the United States understand that without Russian influence in the region, it will have problems pursuing their own ideas. So we need to develop joint proposals. We do. Iran and nuclear issue, we do work together. However, we do experience difficulties in coordinating our diplomatic steps. But we share the goal. We do believe that Iran shouldn't have nuclear weapon. And irrespective of the small difficulties of coordinating tactical steps, by and large, we work together in order to achieve this goal through peaceful means, through negotiations. We do the same in the framework of discussions with DPRK on the nuclear programs. And we work in various mechanisms together when it comes to the non-proliferation on the fight of terrorism, and we sometimes work as one team. So what I'm trying to say that, yes, we do have a downswing in our relations. It's very unfortunate. I think we could have avoided it by working together more honestly in the past, by taking into account legitimate security interests of each other. For us, it means security interests of Russia. But at the same time, we are not back to the Cold War because there is simply no basis for the Cold War. What we are facing, in my view, is the remnants of Cold War mentality in our back in our minds that governs instinct decisions sometimes. And I do not blame only on the United States. What I'm saying is that it's something that's still with us and needs to be dealt with. How to deal with it? By working together, most probably, by trying to be more attentive to the ideas of the other, and certainly by working on practical issues that are of importance to you and are of importance to us. And I can put my salary on the bet that if you try to weight up problems in the world, the so-called new challenge agenda of the 21st century against the differences that we have many more things that we need to do together as opposed to the differences that we have. Now, how we should develop these relations. And when I came to Alaska and I spent only half a day here, I have a feeling that it's a kind of microcosm of how things need to be developing. I had a wonderful meeting today with a number of people who are involved in the bilateral projects between Alaska and various regions in Russia. They are doing smaller and bigger things, education, environment protection, building a joint park, learning about the legal system of each other locally, based on commonality of the challenges that people here in Alaska and people there in Russian Federation face, based on normal human understanding what the values are, and based on the understanding that we stand to gain, both of us. We cooperate rather than quarrel. So here, I think, it's a small area that is very, very particular, where these vestiges of the Cold War mentality are almost absent, at least when it comes to the initiatives of people, NGOs here in Alaska and people in Russia. And it's wonderful. That's, I would say, a micro model for the mentality that need to be prevailing in our relations in a larger context, and I would love to see it develop. Moreover, I would say that when you are here, you understand immediately that the stereotype of Russia being somewhere there in the Far East beyond Europe, and for us, United States being almost Wild West somewhere very far from Russia, is absolutely negated. It's 3 miles distance between two of us. And currently, the time zones here are so difficult to understand, because here it's almost the same time like in Moscow, but they have difficulties to understand what is there, morning or evening, because we are so close, because we share so much together. And it's something that sometimes, as a person who has spent all my life either in Washington or in Moscow, it's difficult to understand. You do not have this feeling of closeness in Washington or in Moscow as it is present here. And it's something that needs to be learned by the others, and I think to expand upon. Thank you very much, and I will be more than ready to answer questions if you have any.
You've been listening to Sergei Ivanovich Kislyak, Ambassador of the Russian Federation to the United States. He spoke about Russia and relations with the United States at the Alaska World Affairs Council in Anchorage, Alaska, on Friday, January 2nd, 2009. Following his talk, he responded to questions from the audience. First, he was asked to comment on how Russia has been affected by the global financial crisis and the precipitous price of oil.
Well, first of all, we are affected by the crisis. And with each and every passing month, we understand that we are affected even more than we expected in the very beginning. However, it's not catastrophic for us for several reasons. One, the initial crisis started here on the stock markets. The prices of the stock markets of Russia also fell down. At the same time, it was more a problem for big industrials and wealthy people than the majority of Russians. Unfortunately, maybe, but less unfortunate for this particular moment, absolute majority of Russian citizens do not have stocks in their portfolios. They do not have portfolios yet. If they have money to save for the future, they usually go to the banks and put them for percentage. We are a young market economy. So the number of companies that are running the stocks, the stock market, is pretty limited. It's less than 100, I think. Those who own these companies, they certainly are affected very, very significantly. But people who live common life, teachers, professionals, they didn't feel from the very beginning the heat of the crisis. The second wave of the same was much more painful. When the prices of oil came down, there was a drop in the orders for oil, steel, many other things that Russia is strong with and providing to the rest of the world. With that, layoffs came. I wouldn't say that it's too wide scale. The psychological perception of uneasiness and uncertainties in the immediate future is stronger than maybe the immediate impact of this economic crisis currently on the normal Russian people. So we felt the heat because we have become an integrated part of the world economy. Most probably we felt it less than some others because we are integrated, but not as strongly as many others, like the EU countries, for example. At the same time, we are increasingly involved in all the financial transactions because we had accumulated quite significant wealth during the last years. We have second largest gold reserves in the world. It's 580 billion dollars at the beginning of the crisis. Currently, it's a little bit less. The government has spent, I think, significant percentage, but not too much, out of these reserves in order to keep the economic system in flow. At the same time, we understand that all these things are difficult, and we will certainly pay our share of the burden for recovery. But it will be not too long before the economic recovery will come. Because for the current crisis, as far as I understand, I'm not an economist, but as far as I understand from what I hear from specialists, is more a lack of certainty and the confidence in the markets than absence of capitals. So if we are all, and when I say we are all, I mean United States, Russia, Europe, and others working together in G20, are able to restore confidence, I think things will start to recovering. So for us, it means that we have to live through several difficult years. The expectation is that we can live through this with some austerity programs, maybe, but not with any big crises, because we do have a reserve of wealth that was built exactly for as a kind of safety net against unexpected developments. The oil price has gone down, and it will certainly affect our national income. But first, it's not the whole Russian income that is insured by the oil sales. We do a lot of other things. However, we stand to gain from a more diversified economy. That is one of the goals of the current government, and we are going to pursue it. But at the same time, the government is strong enough in its belief that we will survive, and we will survive in a way that not a single social economic program that had been announced prior to the crisis is going to be abandoned or restructured. Each and every commitment that the government has given is going to be implemented. They are being implemented. 1st of January has introduced a new rise in the minimum income that people are getting, and it's going to be complied with.
Can you help us understand how most Russians perceive the sale of Alaska to the United States? Do they think it was a wise or unwise move? An audience member asked.
I think that if I offer here in Alaska a refund, and if it is accepted in exchange for Alaska, I would come as a hero of Russia. Well, there is always nostalgia about places and territories that previously one had and currently are prosperous and wonderful environmental zones, but nobody is thinking about taking revenge, taking it back. Even Zhirinovsky, he's a very practical person. He's a very good politician. He knows how to play politics, but he is a very reasonable person, so be calm. We want development of relations of the type we were discussing today in the morning to be on the rise in the years to come. That means we would be better off by working with Alaska and cooperating with Alaska rather than getting it back.
Next, what does your government see as Russia's environmental concerns today, and what are your goals for the future? Another audience member asked.
Well, to be honest, I'm not fully equipped I apologize, I'm not accustomed to that kind of microphones. I'm not yet a superstar. I would say that, yes, we do have a tradition of creating zakazniks and zapovedniks, which in English means parks, national reserves and parks, that had been part of the Soviet Union policies. It's not a Russian invention, and it's going to continue. The problem is that in many cases, these parks were underfunded. Sometimes when we went to economic crises, it was a low priority for the government because it was concentrated mainly on solutions to the economic crises that were persisting in many underdeveloped regions, sometimes at the expense of the protection of the environment. I think things have changed significantly for two things. One, with the increased wealth in Russia, there was a different perception as to what we can do, really, not declare, but can do. And that is one of the reasons why the government is increasing accent on financing national parks and reserves. Secondly, like all others, we do understand the green psychology comes to Russia as well. We understand that we need to protect the wonderful country that we have inherited for our children and our grandchildren. So I think it's going to stay with us. What are our goals? Our goals are to preserve the country, to keep the natural treasures that we enjoy, and we certainly are reaching almost everything. So what else can I say as not being a specialist? I would just like to say that today I heard a wonderful idea of creating a joint park here in Alaska and in Russia. I like it immensely. As a bureaucrat, I do not understand how it can be done. But I think that if one can bring this to the attention of the leadership, we will focus not on the issues why it can be done, but rather what needs to be done in order to make it. Because for all reasons, environmental, and I would say political, and I would say human-to-human relations, it's a brilliant idea that needs to be developed.
Another audience member mentioned joint Russia-Alaska projects, including fisheries research, anti-terrorism exercises, scientific and technical operations that once took place at the border before they were canceled over 20 years ago. He stressed the importance of cooperation between Alaska and Russia as we both face many pressing issues concerning national fisheries, polar bears, and the environment. Why has cooperation between Alaska and Russia failed in the past, he wanted to know, and what can be done to keep scientific and technical operations at the border completely intact?
If it's not a question, but rather a statement, which it was, I fully subscribe. It's something that needs to be, I think, more brought to the attention of the leadership of both countries. We will try to do that. I think that there are interests that are common to you and to us. We have shown to each other that we can work together on problems that we are facing together. And it needs to be expanded. I see only one problem that is a difficulty in our relations that emanates all others, and that is kind of vestiges of the Cold War mentality. And I brought an example to a couple of colleagues today when we were discussing it, that sometimes working with the United States or working with NATO, I had a feeling that they are offering a friendship to us, like during the years of the conquest of the Wild West, you know, like in cowboy movies when a person would extend the hand, shake one hand, and the other will be kept on 038 Magnum. In case you do not like something, you change the hands. And that kind of mentality needs to be overcome. First, secondly, we need to have resources to do things that you are talking about. That mostly isn't the function of our bilateral relations. It's a function of the national priorities your government or our government have, because in order to work on these environmental protection issues, you need to have first and foremost national programs that will be supporting cooperation. And unless these priorities coincide, you wouldn't be able to team up for doing it together. But I think that the dialogue between our two nations needs to be expanded. It will expand. And bit by bit, we can arrive at that kind of understanding, but not without some additional political work. As to the canceled joint exercises, it was a political decision by the U.S. government, totally politically motivated, as to protest against the what was called our brutal invasion of Georgia, which it was not. It was not. If people are interested, I can give you 3 to 4 minutes of the picture on the ground at that time, what was happening. It wasn't an invasion, and my impression was that the U.S. initial reaction to what was happening was as if people here in the States believed that the only reason or the reason for us to use force in order to bring peace there was to topple the government of Georgia because it was planning to go to NATO, which is nonsense. We are not in the business of regime changes anywhere, be it around Russia or any other country. It's not Russian policy, has never been so. And the only reason why we used force was because the president of Georgia has used force against Russian peacekeepers and innocent civilians, majority of whom happen to be Russian citizens. Because in Ossetia, it is a pretty unique situation after the Soviet Union ceased to exist. We had a couple of enclaves in the territory that previously was Georgia that never recognized them to be part of Georgia. In the Soviet Union, former Soviet Union, they were autonomous republics of the Soviet Union. As autonomous republics of the Soviet Union, under the constitution of the Soviet Union, they had a right to choose what they want to be. And they decided that they would be independent. Georgia never recognized it. We had been trying to help to bring peace and mutual accommodation between them for, 15 years. And the only solution that could have been found could be only peaceful, that would bring Georgians and Ossetians together. But in 92, Georgians, under the president, then-president, Gamsakhurdi, they have declared that Georgia was only for Georgians, and they started the war. They started annihilating the tiny, tiny nation of Ossetians. The same happened now. Irrespective of the diplomatic efforts to bring peace there and to find a solution, however difficult and prolonged it was, we warned Saakashvili not to use force, but he decided otherwise. Even the U.S. government, as we had been told, was strongly advising Saakashvili not to use force under no circumstances. On 7th of August, Saakashvili went to TVs addressing Ossetians, said that he was the president. He said, I want you to be sure that I will secure your security. Excuse me for the words. I will protect your security. In 4 hours, he started shelling them with the multiple launched rocket systems. But these people who lived in a strange situation in a country that they declared independent and not being recognized by anybody, they didn't have a passport that would be recognized elsewhere. So some of them chose to become citizens of Russia because under the Russian law, all the citizens of the former Soviet Union had the right to decide who they are. We all went through this situation. And for example, myself, I'm ethnically Ukrainian, I had lived in Russia, I feel a Russian citizen, and I had a choice. When the Soviet Union ceased to exist, what I was to be. I decided that I'm a Russian citizen, I'm going to stay as a Russian citizen, I'm ambassador of Russia. A friend of mine who worked next to me has decided otherwise. He was also Ukrainian. He went to Kyiv, he became Ukrainian. And he became also ambassador of Ukraine to the United States. So each and every of us, Russian citizens, or rather Soviet Union citizens, faced sometimes a dilemma, what to do next. For these people, it was pretty unique. They decided they go independent, but nobody recognized them. 15% of them, as far as I understand, chose Georgian passports. They were Georgian citizens. Others mainly were Russians. So one way or another, the situation developed. Saakashvili started shelling innocent people, peaceful, innocent people. That's what's the problem. So we introduced forces to deny him a chance to kill them. We pushed a little bit further than the borders of Southeast Asia for one simple reason. He was using long-range artillery and multiple launch rocket systems. We had to deny him capability to strike Tsinwali because we were bringing relief supply by civilians to restore life. There was nothing to support life in Tsinwali at that time. No electricity, no running water, no medicine, no nothing. Everything was demolished by Saakashvili. We pushed him further, but we didn't go to take over Tbilisi. We could have, because the distances are very short, 45 kilometers plus minus. But it had never been our political goal. We have never been contemplating anything of the sort. So what I'm returning to is that we need to be more attentive to and honest to the views and feelings of each other, and that would be a prerequisite for working on all the issues that you also mentioned. At the same time, there are a lot of things that, irrespective of the ups and downs that are taking place, we can and we do together now, and it needs to be expanded by a bit, and we need to have people devoted to these programs as they are here in Alaska that I met today, and I'm so happy to have met such people.
There was a report this past summer that the Russian military was using incendiary weapons in South Ossetia this past summer, another audience member stated. What do you see as the future of disarmament between Russia and the United States, he asked.
First, I have never seen a single report about Russian forces using incendiary weapons. There was not a single report. There was no use of such weapons first, but I haven't seen any report on this. There were reports by some NGOs about alleged use of the cassette munitions, I think. But it's something different, and it proved to be very erroneous. But on the incendiary weapons, I even didn't see anything of the kind because there was no ground for such information in the first place. As to the future of arms control, it depends very much as to what the new U.S. administration will decide it wants. There are things that need to be decided upon very fast, and one of them is the fate of the strategic arms reductions, because currently we have an agreement that is successfully implemented, the Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, that expires in December 2009. So the question is, what will come afterwards? Absence of agreement means it's free for all in nuclear weaponry. That would be, I think, very destabilizing. We do not like it. We had been discussing with our American colleagues the so-called concept of the follow-on to start. And we haven't agreed yet, because we had quite a different view as to what these new generation of arms control agreements need to include. We believe that at least, and I underline the word at least, we need to continue what was good in start and go further. We have accumulated the wealth of experience as to how the reductions need to be implemented, because the START proved to be a very successful treaty. We have been successful, when I say we, I mean U.S. and us, in implementing verification procedures in each other facilities. And we have already removed our people from Salt Lake City, where you have a major missile production facility. But your people are still in Izhevsk, in the Urals, in Russia, monitoring the gates of a Russian missile-producing facility. We are very comfortable with that, because it is fully compliant with the treaty and works well, and the treaty has created, I would say, sense of predictability in this field, which is very, very important, an achievement. But now the question is, what's next? because we might end up waking up, all of us, January 1st, 2010, without any agreement limiting or reducing strategic delivery systems, with no agreement on limiting anti-ballistic missile systems. And the only agreement that will be left, that is so-called Moscow Treaty, that is important in itself, but it is a workable solution only on the basis of START 1 or START Treaty continuing, because the Moscow Treaty limits only warheads, not the delivery vehicle. And it worked well when coupled with the agreement that is still in place, the START, that limits both missiles, delivery systems on the aircraft, submarines, plus warheads. So if that is no longer starting January the 1st, that means we lose the underpinning even for this smaller agreement on the numbers of warheads. Our preferred option is to negotiate fast and to pick up elements of the agreement that is already in place, that we know it works. We know even how the procedures works. We have a wealth of experience together with the United States, even in developing and implementing procedures to implement procedures. So everything is clear there. Military know how to do this. So we can pick them up and to agree that we want these elements to continue, we want some to be reduced, and that would be the good first step to make. Secondly, there are big debates now, especially in Washington and NGO, arms control NGOs throughout the world, especially in Europe and Russia, as to where all of us are going to move next beyond the follow-on to stuff. There are a lot of ideas, even supported here in the United States by former foreign secretaries, about going to zero. When I spoke to a number of people who are involved in developing these ideas here, whether they feel it's an immediate possibility, say, of course not. And we understand it's not. But it's certainly a good idea to pursue, but on the way to zero, it's a long, long way that you need to go. But if you have the goal, you need to develop steps in which you would be moving towards this goal. And that certainly needs to include not only Russia and the United States, but it needs to include all the other nuclear weapon countries. And at some point, even those countries that we do not recognize to be legally nuclear weapon countries, that means Israel, Pakistan, and India, to some extent North Korea. Also to assure ourselves that while we would be moving to lower levels, let alone zero, that we wouldn't see appearance of nuclear weapons in other countries. That means we need to have a reinforced non-proliferation regime that needs to be truly global. On non-proliferation, we have a good experience of working together with the United States. I hope it's going to continue. But I think there are a lot of things that can be done. The President-elect Obama has announced his main goals in this area that seem to be encouraging, that dialogue might be possible, but we certainly need to see how things are going to be implemented in real life.
Next, an audience member suggested that perhaps the reason the United States continues to perceive Russia with, quote, a Cold War mentality, unquote, is because it seems, especially lately, that Russia has been very actively engaged with Syria, Venezuela, and some of the rogue regimes. Why is Russia interested in supporting rogue regimes who espouse terrorism? He asked.
First and foremost, we need to start discussing first, in order to agree on something, as to what it is, a rogue regime. It's kind of a term that is loosely used here in this country to label all the countries that are not very much liked in the United States, which doesn't make them necessarily rogue. Secondly, you say that we engage Venezuela. If you take our economic relations with Venezuela and yours would be tenfold or maybe even greater, larger than ours. So in terms of supporting financial system of Venezuela, United States is helping much more to the stability of Venezuela than we do. For us, Venezuela is an important interlocutor and economic partner in Latin America, one of them, but not the biggest, because the biggest is Brazil. We see, in general, Latin America as a very interesting continent for us because we had had previously a lot of ties with them, both economically, politically, ideologically. Ideological closeness is no longer because it's not part of what we are seeking there. We seek cooperation that will bring wealth to Russian companies, and we seek it on the basis of mutual interests. So Syria is an old traditional partner of Russia, and we have been maintaining relations with them for a long, long period of time. I do not know whether if we do anything different lately as opposed to our relations that had enjoyed decades and decades of close cooperation, because it's an important country in the Middle East crisis area, and it's a country that needs to be also part of the solution to the Middle East crisis as well. And we certainly use, among other things, our relations with them in order to bring negotiated solutions to the Middle East crisis in general, not only Israeli-Palestinian, but also Israeli-Syrian discussions that need to be also continued. So what other rogue, quote-unquote, regimes you mean, I don't know. But the whole concept of us supporting rogue regimes is very, very part of what I started my discussion with. The perception of what Russia is and what Russia is not. It's a part of perception that Russia is a challenge, and whatever Russia is doing throughout the world is to challenge U.S. interests. It's not. We are pursuing our own. They are not necessarily mutually contradictory. Thank you very much indeed. I appreciate it.
This concludes Alaska World Affairs Council Presents with the Ambassador of the Russian Federation to the United States, Sergei Ivanovich Kislyak. He responded to questions from the audience following his talk on Russia and relations with the United States, recorded at the Alaska World Affairs Council in Anchorage, Alaska, on Friday, January 2, 2009. These broadcasts are produced by KSKA Public Radio in partnership with the Alaska World Affairs Council. Visit kska.org to sign up for free podcasts of Alaska World Affairs Council Presents. You can also sign up for email updates about the show and share your comments with us and other listeners online at kska.org. This has been a presentation of KSKA in partnership with the Alaska World Affairs Council. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.